Had you got Otter Eel too?
There were certainly in the thousands of French civilians killed. Thirdly, the cratering was such that it prevented our mobile forces exploiting any breakthrough. We, on the other hand, although we had very little time for close strategic bombing, and we felt it was much better used on communications and the back areas, we were immensely grateful and impressed by the 2nd Tactical Air Force, and particularly the rocket-firing Typhoons, who gave us very good close support, particularly in ground that was dead to our shell trajectories. The most harrowing and traumatic battle was Operation Epsom, in which 43rd Division took over from 15th Scottish and 11th Armoured in the assault on Hill 112, exploiting to Malta, with the object of closing the line round Caen between the rivers Odon and Orne. By this time, the whole of the 2nd SS Panzer Corps had arrived from the Russian front, and the 9th SS Panzer Divisions and the 10th SS Panzer Divisions were supplementing the other 6 SS Panzer Divisions, all of which were concentrated on the British front. And our task in capturing Hill 112 and Morto was really a mission impossible, because we were extraordinarily badly outnumbered. We had 2 armoured brigades in our support. It was 4th and I think it was 8th armoured brigades. And the Churchills and Shermans were absolutely no match for the German panzers, the Tigers and the Panthers and the Mark IVs even, and were utterly devastated. Our particular brigade, well, we supported, 112 Field supported 130 Brigade, which was the 4th and 5th Dorsets and the 7th Hampshires. The 4th and 5th Dorsets took a place called Chateau Fontaine, which was at the bottom of the 112 hillside. The 5th Dorsets exploited towards Hill 112, while the 7th Hampshires went through Eptu 4 in an advance to take the village of Morto, which was on the east flank of Hill 112, but led down to the Orne. By the end of the day, all 3 of our battalions were utterly devastated, and the 4th Somersets were passed through the 5th Dorsets, and also the 5th DCLI, which was from 214 Brigade, and they attempted to hold Hill 112, which they did for some time, until again they became a non-fighting unit, having had, I think on average, most of these battalions within the 2 days had something like between 400 and 500 casualties each. out of their establishment of six or seven, well, I suppose it was 700 or 800. But they'd fought themselves to a standstill, and Hill 112 was back in no man's land, and Morto was recaptured. It was another 10 days, by which time Caen had been taken by the Canadians, before we actually re-established ourselves on top of Hill 112 and in Morto. As far as the gunners were concerned, we were firing continuously, mostly onto our own forward positions or on the periphery around them. And we did have some singularly complimentary comments from the infantry that we had largely saved the day for them and saved them from complete annihilation. And in the midst of all this, obviously a lot of I think three or four of our FOOs were killed or wounded. So we had a pretty high FOO casualty rate at that time. And the gun positions were under constant counter-bombardment fire, and we had considerable casualties on the gun positions.
Did you have any narrow escapes yourself?
Yes, indeed I did. There were the particular one that I would like to record is that because an OP had been knocked out, I was due to man a Churchill tank in this assault on Hill 112. But the day I was due to go, we had a reinforcement drafted in, Captain Robertson, who took my place in the tank, and within a quarter of an hour he was killed. So that was, I thank God for that one. The next day I was sent up to the OP at Chateau Fontaine, which was our forward position at the bottom of Hill 112, and I was with the forward infantry in the trenches when there was a Nebelwerfer stonk. The Nebelwerfer, as you probably know, is a six-barrel mortar, which was a terrifying weapon. And the infantry in the trench beside me had shrapnel wounds because they were landing on trees above them. And I set off from my OP position back to my armoured vehicle, which was a field back, behind a hedge, a field back. And as I rushed across this open field, the Nebelwerfers opened up on me and on my field, and I crossed the whole of that field with Nebelwerfer bombs around me and didn't get a scratch. And when I got to my OP truck, I found that my signaller had been wounded by the same stonk. So again, I think I can classify that as a pretty near miss. Those are two. There were various, you know, throughout the campaign, there were odd things like that, really. But throughout I was lucky, and I didn't actually have a scratch.
What did you think of your unit's equipment at that time?
The 25-pounder was a gun we absolutely adored, and the infantry adored it. It was a highly efficient, accurate gun with a good, reasonably good range. I mean, up to, well, it went up to 13,000 yards, but effectively up to about 10,000 yards. And it was substantially accurate at that range. Most of our firing was probably down to about 4,000 yards or 3,000 yards. There were odd occasions when we fired over open sights, but not very often. If I could talk about the effectiveness of gunnery, we, I think, as a nation, had a very high reputation for our gunnery. And certainly through our infantry, I mean, I remember General Horrocks, who was our 30 Corps commander, was devoted to the gun and considered that the gunners had done more to win the war than his own infantry. The interesting fact was that although in our exercises in the UK we had practiced mainly observed shooting by FOOs, in practice, probably 80% of our shooting was predicted. And again, this imposed a strain on accuracy because we had to feed in, obviously, the correction of the moments, the meteor. We had to feed in things like difference in angle of sight, things like the muzzle velocity of individual guns, and so on, into this equation. And it was a quite mathematically demanding, and it was a 24-hour job. I mean, my command battery command post, we were on duty 24 hours a day, day after day after day, feeding individual angles of sight, range, and bearings to the guns, our battery guns, and this was being done obviously through the division. One of the great experiences and expertise we had, which was largely generated, I may say, by our CRA and by General Thomas, both of whom were ex-gunners, was in concentration of divisional fire and core targets. And this we were probably uniquely experienced in, I think, in 21 Army Group. Certainly the Germans had no comparative communications control over assembling 3,300 guns onto one concentrated target or on a barrage or a stonk linear target, and it worked extraordinarily well. Although I'm perhaps being I'm subjective, obviously, as a gunner. But it was amazing how accurate these concentrations of fire were. There were, of course, a lot of friendly fire casualties because we were largely shooting within 100 yards of our own troops. But the great majority of our shells, and this is a tribute not only to the guns but to the makers of the ammunition and the fuse makers, that we had very few dud, very little dud ammunition, compared, for example, with the Germans, because there was one occasion I record in my diary when on the gun position 40% of the counter-battery shells were dud. So there we are. I'm very proud of having served the 25-pounder gun. And I have an enormous admiration for my soldiers, and particularly the GPOX, who largely worked on the predictions. We had a meteor every 4 hours.
Can you explain the term, please?
Pardon?
Can you explain the term, please?
The meteor was... as a result of, there were meteorological units with us in the forward areas, and they were sending up their balloons, etc., etc. And the meteor came to us in the form of air density, wind direction and speed at various trajectories, barometric pressure at our point above sea level, all of which affected the trajectory of the shell. And these had to be translated into adjustments to the standard range and bearing on which the gun was pointed for a particular target. And because most of our fire was predicted, it was nearly all registered. Targets were registered, sort of harassing fire targets and defensive fire targets, and areas known to contain German troops, were all registered and given a number. And the guns had updated data for all these targets that had been registered, so that instead of having to give the detail of bearing, range and angles of sight and so on, all we had to do was to call DF-24, and the guns already had that data, and then every 4 hours that data was updated. That was, of course, while we were in static positions, but constantly we were moving. So when we were moving, we really had to register, keep registering new targets all the way through.
Now, if we can go back to the battle, please, because you were describing the fight for Hill 112.
Yes, I was. And it was eventually successful. And it is interesting that not so long ago I came across a book called Impossible Victories by a chap called Brian Perrott, which contained the stories of 10 what he considered impossible victories, military victories of the last two centuries. And interestingly enough, number 8 was called the Crown of Thorns, the Battle for Hill 112. And it is recorded as being a victory against impossible odds. And I think that sums up that particular battle, which was indeed 43rd Wessex Division's first major battle. Immediately after that, there was Operation Goodwood, which was the attempt to break out south of Colne. And we then moved over to the centre of the line because the Americans had just taken St. Lo and started breaking out south. Our division was then directed south from the Caumont area, where our major achievement was to capture Mount Pinson, which was a strategical hillside dominating the whole of North Normandy. And this was captured by our division with the help of 8th Armoured Brigade. And by this time, we were under 30 Corps, and General Brian Horrocks had just come out to take over. This capture of Hill 112 was probably one of the most important elements in the closure of the Falaise Gap, in the sense that it denied the Germans a strategical defensive position and led immediately to their withdrawal to the Falaise area. They had, of course, Hitler had, of course, made the fatal mistake of directing 4 divisions in a counterattack against the Americans at Mortain, which meant that the whole of the 7th and the 15th German armies were really being entrapped by the pincer movement, with the Canadians and ourselves going south to Falaise, and the Americans right flanking coming up north from, I think it was Alençon, I think was the name of the major town. But despite that, quite a percentage of the German remnants of the German armies escaped to and over the Seine. They escaped the closure of the gap. The battle finished, I think, something like the 18th or 20th of August. And it's interesting to note that whereas Montgomery was being torn apart in Normandy for dilatoriness and inability to break out, bearing in mind that I think it was 8 out of 9 of the panzer divisions were concentrated quite deliberately on the British front as part of his strategy. The fact was that we had completed the capture of Normandy and were lined up on the Seine by D plus 75, whereas the original overlord plan was D plus 90, which exonerated, I think, Montgomery from the criticism of Patton, and particularly Tedder, the deputy supreme commander, who was the most critical of Montgomery's detractors. Immediately after the end of the Normandy campaign, 43rd Division was directed by Horrocks to cross the American thrust, which was thrusting north between Normandy and the Seine, to a town called Vernon on the Seine. It was about an 80-mile march across the LFC of the Americans, where we were directed to do an assault crossing of the Seine at this place, Vernon. It took us possibly a couple of days to get across there, and we were under strict instructions to keep invisible, so it was a supreme surprise. The assault crossing, both the bridges at Vernon had been destroyed. There was a road bridge and a railway bridge. Both had been destroyed, and our division was sent across in an assault crossing. And in 4 days, we had captured a bridgehead against stiff opposition on the escarpment on the east side of the Seine at a place called Vernonette, which was full of, I may say, caves, and the Germans were manning these caves and had direct observation down onto the river and onto the site of the bridges that were being built by our sappers. And the only help they had was from our smoke screens, our gun smoke screens, which we were directing at them. The bridgehead by this time had penetrated about 4 miles inland. And one of the interesting captures, or liberations really, was what's his name, the artist, I better stop now. We actually captured Monet's house and his garden. Of course, we weren't terribly interested in his house or his garden at the time, but that was one interesting little area that we captured. Now, the two bridges were a class 40 bridge and a Class 10 bridge, which were named David and Goliath. And these were completed at the expense of 80 of our sappers killed in the construction of them. Immediately they were completed, the Guards Armoured Division and the 11th Armoured Division and 8th Armoured Brigades were passed over these two bridges and were sent off on their Swan, which was without any, I think, any battle, into the First World War battlefields, which were captured, I think, within about 3 or 4 days, with hardly a round being fired. And they, within 4 days, the Guards Armoured were in Brussels and the 11th Armoured were in Antwerp. So that our assault crossing of the Seine had resulted in an advance of something like 200 miles to the Dutch border. In the meantime, we actually had our first rest day, rest camp of about 10 days on the east side of the Seine, where we re-equipped and where the infantry, who by this time had been utterly devastated. I mean, we lost over 6,000 troops of our something like 14,000 division in Normandy, and another over 500 on the assault crossing of the Seine. So that these 10 days were spent with the infantry being reinforced, and indeed ourselves being reinforced, because we'd lost probably 100 people by this time. And we recalibrated our guns. We had Ensa come over with Flanagan and Allen, and Florence Desmond, I remember, came over and did a thing for us. And this was foreshortened because we were then called up to the Escaut Canal on the Dutch border for Operation Market Garden and the Battle of Arnhem. We had a couple of days preparing for that particular battle. We then fired our opening fire plan for the Guards Armoured Div to break out of their little bridgehead over the Escaut Canal, and that was on the 17th of September when the three airborne divisions were dropped in the Grave, Nijmegen and Arnhem areas, and the Guards Armoured Division was sent off to link with them, followed by the 43rd Wessex Division. And we were 2 days before we actually moved, and during that time we fired continuous fire plans in support of 8th Corps and 12th Corps on 30 Corps' flanks, which were attempting to broaden the single track access through Eindhoven, Sens and Nijmegen. I may say that we had our worst casualty episode at that time, because one night we had a bombing raid by 50 German fighters. It's the first time we'd seen a fighter probably for about 3 weeks. And this was at night, and they dropped anti-personnel mines, which killed 5 of our gun crew and wounded another 4. Now, in infantry terms, this is not very much, but 9 represents 1.5 guns out of 8. So we were deficient of gun crews, And bearing in mind that our guns were manned and firing 24 hours a day, this put a most hell of a strain on our battery. 2 days later, we set off up the axis, which was called Club Route. 30 Corps axes were always called Club Route, which was a single track, a single road.